and talk Bitcoin now, and Andrew. I was thinking ARK, because if you feel bad about Bitcoin, if you're an ARK,
double and tripling down on all of
ARK's down 70%, 68% from its high.
Double down.
Yeah. So who's not underwater? Is there anyone not underwater in ARK?
We're going to talk to Robert yesterday. Frank later about not ARK but ART, and ART apparently is not underwater. But we're going to
no. Well, everybody still loves Marilyn. We've talked about her a lot this week. The dress at the Met Gala, and he made five of those. That was smart. Is that $1 billion?
Well, not for him.
No, but if you add up what it sold for, it's $1 billion.
If it was an NFT, maybe he'd get a piece. let's talk Bitcoin just for a second, because Bitcoin prices this morning, cryptocurrency briefly dropped below 30,000 late yesterday. It's regained some ground early this morning. We're at about $31,449 right now. Bitcoin, though, we should say off about 55% from its November peak, and 40% of holders are now underwater on their investments. That's according to some new data out from Glassnode that says that in the last month alone, 15.5% of all Bitcoin wallets fell into unrealized losses. So
I thought it was more. I thought it might have been more, but it doesn't, because there's holders that have been holding for longer than that. But 40%, I mean, it was at 66, right? So you would think it could even be worse in terms of the number of people that have an unrealized.
But that goes to the holder mentality. How many people do you know who've been owning since they 10,000, 20,000, 5,000, right?
Right. I don't have a single one that I bought higher than where it is right now. So, and I don't have a lot. I don't have a lot. But I have those. I got one as low as 4,900. Stocks to watch.
Happy Bitcoin Tuesday, freaks. That clip that we just started off the show with CNBC, now addicted to on-chain analysis, as well as the rest of Bitcoin Twitter, and Joe Kernan bragging about not being underwater on his Bitcoin holdings. Happy Bitcoin Tuesday to you all. This is your boy Odell here for another Citadel Dispatch, the interactive live show about Bitcoin and freedom tech. Dispatch is 100% audience funded without ads or sponsors, focused purely on actionable Bitcoin discussion. I want to thank everyone who continues to support the show and makes that mission possible. I really do appreciate it. The easiest way you can support the show is through podcasting 2.0 apps. My two favorites are Fountain Podcasts and Breeze Wallet. You simply download the app, works like a regular podcast app. You load it up with sats and you choose how many sats per minute you think Dispatch is worth, and it streams those sats directly to my node. You can also support the show via the BTC Pay server instance at CitadelDispatch.com through on-chain or Lightning, as well as through my BIP47 reusable payment code listed on the website. Although you can obviously listen to Dispatch on podcasting 2.0 apps, you can also listen to it on any other podcasting app. My favorite is Antennapod. You simply just search Citadel Dispatch in those apps. If you don't have sats to spare to support the show, clicking the subscribe button, leaving a review, sharing it with your friends obviously helps tremendously. Dispatch is also broadcast on Twitch and Bitcoin TV as a video show with all archives on BitcoinTV.com. You can find all those links at CitadelDispatch.com. Dispatch also has a live audience chat. I want to thank all the freaks who continue to join us week in, week out in the audience chat. You guys make it truly special and unique by participating in the discussion. That chat can be found at CitadelDispatch.com and clicking that Citadel chat link Now, that group now is over 1,000 Bitcoiners. We have conversations all throughout the week, not just on Bitcoin Tuesdays. So consider joining us. Really high quality conversation there. Last but not least, a new way to support Dispatch is through the Podcasting 2.0 Boost feature. I've been trying to experiment with different value for value models in terms of supporting the show without corporate sponsors. And the Boost feature basically allows you to choose how many sats you want to send to Dispatch and include a message with it through Podcasting 2.0 apps. So that works on both Fountain Podcasts and Breeze Wallet. And as part of that, I think what I'm going to do going forward is that if you do a Boost that's over 100,000 sats, I will read it on the following show. I'll read your message on the following show. And if nobody has any Boosts above 100,000 sats, I will read the two highest paying ones. And we'll start from there and see where it goes. A bunch of freaks actually posted comments from 2 weeks ago's Nostr episode, the censorship resistant alternative to Twitter and a bunch of other things. And some of those comments were pretty fun. One was early but interesting. Thanks for all the helpful content. That came from an anonymous user. At Bond said end of month Boost for no ad podcasts and that Nostr sounds super interesting. Following Will's Nostr programming updates on Twitter have been good. Vake said, hi, this is Vake, testing Fountain App's Boost feature. Really compelling comment from Vake. And Letter 6173 said, your show is a godsend. I wouldn't go that far, but I appreciate the sentiment regardless. With all that said, we have a very important conversation today. We are going to be talking about the Lightning and Bitcoin development process and how changes get implemented into Bitcoin. Specifically, we will be talking about the CTV proposal that has been very controversial recently. Potentially, we'll be talking about Bolt 12 on Lightning, and we'll be talking about Rusty's new proposal, which is an alternative to CTV called OpTX. So with all that said, I want to introduce our two guests. We have Rusty Russell here. How's it going, Rusty?
Hey, I'm good, Matt. It's bright and early here, but hopefully I will stay awake for this. I've had my coffee, so we should be good to go.
We appreciate you joining us so early in your day. It is truly grateful for that. And we have Shinobi with us. How's it going, Shinobi?
Going all right. I appreciate being brought on here to voice my support for government whitelists.
And we end the conversation. So where do you guys want to start? I was thinking more of a general overview of what the Bitcoin development process is and how changes get implemented. It seems like a lot of people are confused about how that all goes down. What do you think?
Yeah, we can certainly start there, right? It's supposed to be confusing as part of the answer, right? I think so. You know, it's sort of constructionist kind of anarchy. So I think the thing to bear in mind, right, is that we are all discovering how this stuff works, right? And that is true universally, right? What is the best way to do an upgrade to the protocol is still an open question, right? But, you know, we can talk about how it has been done in the past, successfully or unsuccessfully, and, you know, get some inspiration from that. I know, is that fair, Shinobi?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. I mean, like the way I conceptualize the whole thing is you just have an anarchic mob. And if you want to upgrade things, well, get up there and convince the mob to do something. Yeah. I mean, I can't really think of any other way to describe it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, I think if everyone decides some upgrade is going to happen, then it happens. The question, like, you know, the messy details are in how does that actual decision process, you know, happen, and how do people know there's an upgrade going on? How do people know they're supposed to, you know, upgrade their node and do things? I guess the important thing with Bitcoin is it's always backwards compatible, right? Nobody goes in and breaks stuff. That may not be a rule that's true forever. It's possible one day we'll do what's called a hard fork, but usually we're talking about a soft fork, which means that all the stuff that works will keep working. There's just sort of, you know, new things added, basically. Technically, it means that things, that new rules are added, but rules are never taken away. And that makes it backwards compatible. So if you take the 0.3 Bitcoin version with a couple of fixes, it will happily sink the current Bitcoin chain. Nobody's doing any non-backwards compatible changes. And so we're talking about a soft fork here, a backwards compatible change. And importantly, even a backwards compatible change could be bad, right? A backwards compatible change could be, block 9 coins can no longer be spent, right? So that we've just stolen Satoshi's coins. That would be backwards compatible with the network. It would also be a really bad idea and would probably not, my node would never run such software, right? So, just because it's backwards compatible doesn't mean it's a good thing to do, but it's kind of a minimum bar. We want backwards compatible changes that don't break anything. And all the changes we're talking about as well are things that pretty much if you don't use them, they don't hurt you, right? That's also kind of a minimum bar, I think, that people have, right? Is there opt-in changes?
Yeah. I mean, I also think like another important aspect of that to consider is the actual coordination of a change. Because, there is this conception that's pretty widely held amongst a lot of non-technical users that like a soft fork magically means there is no possibility of a chain split, but with a hard fork there is. And the reality is if the coordination of activating something, goes wrong or is not complete or starts in the wrong place, like there absolutely is the risk of chain splits, even though an upgrade is being done through a soft fork.
Yeah, absolutely. So, so let's talk about, let's kind of come down to brass tacks with being very abstract, right? So let's look at op CTV. So this proposal takes op no op 4, which is basically something that does nothing at the moment in Bitcoin. If you put that in your little Bitcoin script, hey, in order to, every Bitcoin script, we should probably talk about what it is, right? Every output in Bitcoin, every coin has a list of conditions that say who can spend it, right? Or how you need to spend it. And usually that's, if you have this, if you can produce a signature for this public key, it's yours, take it, right? That's the simplest script. It's got abbreviations. It's so common. That's the most normal use of script. But you can have other things. You have a little program in there. It says, you have to basically make this program work. So this would take op not 4, which currently does nothing, and makes it do something, right? In this case, it checks that the top thing on the stack matches the thing that it produced by opnop 4, the template verify thing. So it adds a new rule, right? Now, if all the nodes were to start enforcing this rule, and your node didn't, and somebody used opnop 4 the old way, just as a junk opcode, all the upgraded nodes would go, no, that means a special thing now, and this doesn't work anymore. You don't meet the conditions. We did that op not 4, which is now CTV, and no, your program doesn't work anymore. You can't spend those coins. Then you'd have a chain split, right? Your node would go, whatever, I'm ignoring that. That's fine. Everyone else would go, no, that doesn't work. You can't spend that coin. By definition then, right, you'd have a split. Now, in order for you to actually get a split, you'd have to have a miner that is going to mine a block that contains that transaction that treats it the old way and ignores the stuff. But it could certainly happen. And that's why we try to get everyone to kind of upgrade at once. We don't want to have gratuitous chain splits and everything else. In particular, if all the miners upgrade, then no one's going to produce an invalid block. You're not going to get a chain split. Even if you haven't upgraded, you're probably pretty good. So there is definitely some staging in how we like to do our upgrades, so it's not too messy.
And yeah. I feel like we skipped a step here, at least in the explanation process, of why we don't have auto updates for Bitcoin. Which is
well, because then developers would just be in charge of everything, and that's
exactly because then it's a vulnerability. Basically, it's a vulnerability that whoever is in charge there can push through unwanted changes. Right?
Yeah. Why not just have the developers decide who gets all the coins? There's no auto update as a general rule for Bitcoin Core. There's no auto update. I mean, other software can definitely have auto updates. It depends on your level of trust. What do you fear more? That there's going to be a bug that you're going to need to push an auto update to save everything, or that that your developer's going to go rogue and steal all your coins? There's never been an auto update. There was this alert key feature in Bitcoin early on, right, that allowed you to basically send a message out to all the nodes and say, hey, do something. If it was signed by this magic key that some of the developers had, that was ripped out quite a while ago. But that was kind of a nod towards this idea that there might be some oh crap moment where early on, you know, you might have had to tell everyone, oh crap, can you upgrade because we found this horrific bug or something. But yeah, I think we're hopefully, you know, you can never be sure with software, but hopefully we're past those days. And either way, the alert key's long gone. So no, there's no auto upgrade. Everyone's got to kind of, in theory, everyone like looks at the software and goes, yes, I like it. Okay, we're all good to go. And they tell all their friends and we all kind of upgrade around the same time. And we don't end up with any chain forks and stuff like that. And that's generally worked pretty well, but it is pretty chaotic.
Yeah, and you know, I think a huge like aspect of the whole coordination process for SoftWorks to spot is miners' involvement. Like a lot of the problems and nonsense from say 7 years ago or so was around the dynamic of miners upgrading first and the importance of that. And like the entire original reason for that was not giving miners some disproportionate vote or influence or anything like that. It was solely to prevent the risk of a chain split, because you have to have miners mining invalid transactions according to the old rules or the new rules in order to have that chain split occur. And so the entire reason of miners signaling and miners like taking that role in the activation process was solely a kind of defense against that risk with a soft fork, like no, like kind of giving disproportionate control or influence to them. It was simply a safety mechanism to try to reduce the risk of a chain split as much as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And to some extent, you know, if like, you know, the classic 51% attack, if 51% of the miners go rogue, in theory, they can start unpicking old blocks and create a new chain. So, you know, there's already some level of responsibility there. And so going, okay, cool. Well, you know, we'll just get them to upgrade to some extent makes a deal of sense. On the other hand, it doesn't matter what miners do. If
did we lose a Rusty?
I think we did. I thought maybe it was my side. The miners censored him.
Uh-oh.
Well, hopefully he jumps back in. In the meantime, Shinobi, there was the term vote was just thrown around. The way I kind of look at implementing Bitcoin changes and like this loose Bitcoin governance process is that there are multiple stakeholders. You have miners, you have devs, and then maybe you have users that aren't devs or miners. I kind of look at it like all of those people all have a veto. Do you think that's like a good way of looking at it, or is that a?
I mean, I don't
a good perspective or
veto I don't than think a vote. Veto or vote is really like a accurate way to represent it. Like I just always come back to the idea of a mob that just happens to all be doing the same thing, moving in the same direction, and the process of changing being trying to convince them to do something different. Like I don't see things so much as a vote or a veto, just as like people are free to do whatever they want. Like you can always break off and form your own mob. Like there is nothing that keeps you a part of this one. And ultimately it just comes down to like, how willing are people to do that? And how long will they stick that out if they do that, in order to see, you know, whether people will follow them or stick with the mob that they broke off from. So it's not so much, I think, a veto or a vote, as it is just like, how much value do you see in being part of the biggest mob? And like, how far will you take that game of chicken in terms of like threatening or actually breaking off from that?
That makes sense to me. That's a pretty good perspective. I guess where I got the veto from is like, if I'm using my own node and I don't update it, I am basically individually saying I am not going with whatever change is being made, right?
Yeah, but I mean, in the case of a soft fork, obviously, though, right. As long as miners choose to not disrupt things, then you are still going to, you know, stay part of the larger mob. But you are kind of choosing, like, consciously, if you're paying attention at least, to open yourself up to the possibility that you could be broken off into, like, another mob by some other actor inside of it.
I like that perspective. It's a good framing. And Rusty, you're back. And he is not.
He is back.
Sorry. He is back.
You got 51% attacked.
You're just about to talk about the miners and they cut you off.
Those stealthy miners. Yeah, actually, I do not know. I could still hear you. You could not hear me. I don't know why. anyway, hopefully I'm back now. Yeah, miners. So to some extent, you know, there's a reason to go through the miners, but it doesn't matter because your node checks everything. And so if the miners start producing what your node considers to be crap, it will just drop those blocks on the floor. So at the end of the day, you know, you have control over what your software does. Now, that may not help you if everyone else goes the other way and you're the only one running your particular weird variant of Bitcoin and no one's mining it. Sure. But that is the ultimate control, right? Is the economic control, right? If the vast majority of people who use and have Bitcoin believe the rules are a certain way and their software enforces that, then that's what Bitcoin is. I'm sorry, you know, like it or not, there's definitely an economic majority argument. It doesn't really matter what the miners do. And importantly, in a meta sense, the miners will follow those people because those people have the money, right? So the miners really are relying on that block reward, right? That's why they're mining, presumably. At least most of them are doing it for a profit motive. And if they mine something else with their machines and no one accepts those blocks, they don't get paid. At least not in any meaningful sense, right? If there's only, you know, three people in the world who accept that weird Bitcoin fork, that's not going to pay the bills. And so they are incredibly economically sensitive to what your node does if the vast majority of nodes are going the same way. So there is definitely a kind of standoff here where, you know, the miners kind of seem to have some signaling control, but they definitely are having to follow the economic majority in the end. So it is actually really important that people run their own nodes and check their own stuff and look after their own things. And the miners will have to follow.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of learned that lesson. Well, not learned, but had it reinforced last year during Taproot activation. I was being a cheeky smartass and patched my node to start enforcing Taproot from the Genesis block. And then Wang Chung and F2Pool decided to sweep some Taproot outputs that developers created while testing before enforcement started. And so my node is still sitting quietly in the corner waiting for everyone else to come back to the real Bitcoin. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is kind of important. I mean, to some extent, like this is true of any money, right? If no one else accepts your money, that's good for you. But it's, you know, you're always economically reliant on this at least somewhat that there would be another group of people who recognize the same money as you. Otherwise, it's not really money. Because trading with yourself generally isn't very interesting. Right. So, you know, it's kind of fundamental to the problem. So the fact that Bitcoin has this issue that, you know, you need to all agree on it is actually just a question of degree. Right. All monies have this issue. Anything you treat as money, you kind of need to have another group of people who agree. It doesn't have to be everyone, but, you know, it has to be enough. So it's not like Bitcoin created a new problem here. It's just that's just how it is. And that's it in life. Right. If no one else, you know, agrees with you about the rules, you're going to have a hard time.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, I think now might be a good time to kind of shift towards covenants, yep. Just to like actually be able to get into that deeply. I do want to say, though, before you get into that as the expert here, Rusty, that, yeah, I actually for a long time, and I'm kind of just coming around to the counter arguments against this, I was one of those people that was like concerned with the fungibility implications of covenants and the potential to kind of create UTXOs that could be perpetually locked into some more restrictive condition in perpetuity. And yeah, I'm seeing like the arguments for why like that doesn't fundamentally change the fact that you can do that type of thing with other mechanisms that already exist. But I'm still kind of on the fence of just opening the door of a covenant that does not require pre-computing what it's committing to ahead of time, just because when it comes to things like second layers on Bitcoin, I am really hesitant to kind of just open the floodgates of things that could potentially interact with minor incentives, specifically like things like side chains that have a direct involvement with miners. And so like I see the fungibility concerns are kind of just arguing like, why do we want to enable something that you can already do? But I'm still kind of skeptical and a little cautious around the idea of just opening the floodgates of not requiring that pre-computation, because that's really what opens the door to just general like constructs that can do whatever you want.
Okay. You kind of jumped right to the end there, but that's a good sketch, right? So let's talk about fungibility, right? So fungibility is basically every coin can be treated as every other coin. And it's really important to address a misunderstanding here. Covenants are something you opt into. I can't covenant your coins, right? You can covenant your coins. I can covenant my coins, right? You can't. Right. And then this is an important misunderstanding, right? So the way Bitcoin works is you have control over your coins. You have a certain number of outputs, technically, on the blockchain that you can spend, because you have the secret key that lets you sign for them, right? And they have little rules that say that, you know, you need the key to this thing in order to spend this coin, right? And that's all Bitcoin is, like a list of outputs, a list of rules. Very simple. And everything else you don't have control over. Right, for better or worse, other people have those secret keys, or they've lost them, or they sent them to bogus addresses, like the one Bitcoin Eater address and stuff. And there's no known secret key for it, and they're gone. So, step one in Bitcoin is always to accept that the vast majority of Bitcoin are not under your control, and you just have to kind of live with that. You know, they're controlled by sovereigns. You may not know in many cases who controls them, but they're gone. So you can't control what other people do with their Bitcoin already. Right, and they can do insane things, and they have. And you hope that this whole money argument, right? You hope the vast majority of them don't do things that you consider ridiculous, because that will, you know, not directly affect your Bitcoins. You'll still have your control of your Bitcoins, but they could totally, you know, if everyone else decides tomorrow that it's all worthless, then, you know, your economic value goes to zero. And so it doesn't really matter that you technically control your Bitcoins, good for you, right? Or they decide, you know, on some weird hard fork or soft fork, whatever happens, right?
So yeah, it's the existential crisis of Bitcoin. Like if tomorrow every other Bitcoiner just decided that they're going to lock their coins and do a 2 of 2 multi-sig where the government controls the keys and refuse to accept anything else, like you can't do anything about that. Like that's just possible.
Everyone decides tomorrow gold is worthless and the price goes to zero, right? So, you know, it is this existential crisis that you can't do anything about. So, can you make it technically more difficult for people to do this? Yes, you can, but that boat already sailed. With Taproot, it is not even more expensive to make something a 2 of 2, right? So, if everyone decided they wanted to have this, okay, we're going to hand our coins over to some control entity that is going to co-sign every transaction that we have. You're totally allowed to do that. And it used to be before Taproot, that would be a bit more expensive for you to spend your coins because you'd have to have two signatures, not one. And,
I mean,
a bit of a technical penalty.
technically with ECDSA multi-party computation, you could even have done it before Taproot. It's just a lot more complicated to coordinate.
Exactly. So, you know, but definitely we opened the door to that, and it's like, okay, great. So now you can have a signal thing that's combined these two signatures. You could do it today. Go nuts. And to be fair, it's not just theoretical, right? We have this on Blockstream, who, disclaimer, I work for. We have our Liquid sidechain, and if you're dealing with registered securities on the Liquid sidechain, we co-sign everything. It's called AMP Asset something acronym. Anyway,
management platform.
Thank you. Yeah, and it's basically a co-signing for all the things, right? That's how we control. We go, cool, is this person allowed to have a transfer? Yes, they are. Great. So we can transfer that. So it's not like a theoretical technology. This already exists. It's totally the way you would do an evil coin control thing, right? So the idea that Covenants introduces this is actually worse. That's not how you would do your evil coin. You would not want to give up control. Covenants fundamentally let you control how your coins are spent. Now, you already can control how your coins are spent, right? You can say, hey, you need this public, you know, you need to have this secret key and make a signature for me, or you need to have these two keys, or, you know, you need to get this evil government corporation or government organization to sign off on your thing, whatever it is. You can already set those for your stuff. That's fine. It's just a question of degree. Now, what's really interesting here, right, is Bitcoin could have just been released with, you know, say single signature, right? The most common use is like, hey, you got to have a signature for this key and you're done. Bitcoin could have just had that ability from day one, and it did, but it did it in a very weird way, right? It did it in this by having this generic little program attached to every output. And Satoshi originally claimed that basically if he didn't put it in at the beginning, then it would never be put in later. And this was the programmable money thing. And it is weird because you're already talking about a revolution in this kind of, you know, this money thing. Why would you add this feature as well? It seems like a real go out on a limb stretch thing, right? It makes the system much more complicated. It makes them not fungible, right? Instead of every spend being the same, you just add a signature and you go. Now you've got this thing has this weird encumberment that everyone can see. And so that coin looks nothing like any other coin. And the language he used was, you know, not ridiculously powerful, but reasonably powerful. It's like this fourth base language with all these different instructions, like add one and add these two numbers together and subtract this and compare with this and all this stuff that you can do. And it's generally, you know, the 99% of transactions do not use this at all. But it was very foresighted, right? It turns out that some of the stuff that we didn't even know that we wanted to do really, like the Lightning Protocol stuff, uses a small fraction, to be honest, of this scripting capability. And in fact, we have enhanced it since then. And this is the trick, right? Satoshi actually had some powerful stuff in there that he pulled out because he was concerned that the implementations were probably vulnerable to various denial of services. So he just kind of ripped a bunch of fairly powerful opcodes out for technical reasons. And we are perhaps very slowly experimenting with kind of putting stuff back and doing things in a better way. But the idea that there's these weird non-fungible, like different coins out there, that boat has already sailed. Bitcoin is already there. We have this weird script capability that we don't use very much. And we're looking at, you know, hey, how do we enhance it? And we over the years have enhanced it in little ways. If we look at like check sequence verify and check time lock verify, these were two soft forks that basically let you say, ha, you can spend this, but your transaction has to be time locked after a certain point, basically. So you can only spend this in the future. So you could lock an output and say, hey, you can only spend this in 6 months' time or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a kind of a covenant.
Yeah. And that was also an optimization from, like something Satoshi built that was not as functional. Like you only had the unlock time, so you could only do that previously with pre-signed transactions. You couldn't actually time lock the script, which was a huge extension of what Satoshi did.
Yeah, he did it as it's a covenant, right? It says your transaction must look like this. In this case, your unlock time must be greater than or equal to some value, right? It is exactly a covenant. It's a very limited covenant, but you know it's been very powerful. So you can,
I mean, I would argue the semantics there a little bit in that it doesn't limit the destination of the transaction, which I think of that as like the defining characteristic of a covenant is like limiting where it can be spent.
Okay, that's the Rubicon for you. Fair enough. I accept that. But it was certainly the first, you look at the transaction itself to see whether or not you can spend it rather than it just satisfies the script and you're good to go. But Satoshi definitely threw this kind of, here's a generic kind of forth-like language that we'll put in the scripting language with a kind of an idea that we wanted this programmable money. Now, why did we want this programmable money? It's an interesting question, right? Why didn't Satoshi just go, no, you just have multi-signatures and you can have two things sign off. You can have this, other entity that will sign off for you and that can enforce all these rules. We don't even need this complication. We don't need it. Why do we have it? And when you think about it, the only reason you have this is because multi-party stuff, right? You don't need to encumber your own coins. Like, you presumably trust yourself to sign it or not sign it, right? But thinking one step ahead, you want the Bitcoin system to enforce these rules. And the only reason you'd want that is because there's multiple people involved, right? So even while other people were still grappling with the idea of Bitcoin and how we would send money to each other and all this stuff, this is already one step ahead and talking about how will multiple people construct these, financial instruments together and create these transactions together in a way that they don't have to trust each other or things like that. So scripting is all about multiple parties interacting and not having to have yet another thing that they trust. They can do it all in Bitcoin. So I don't think there's a, there's no clear line for me between the scripting system we have today and any slightly more powerful system that lets you control how you can spend stuff, because we're already kind of there. Now, people talk about recursive versus non-recursive covenants, right? A non-recursive covenant says basically your outputs must look exactly like this. And a recursive covenant can say, they must look, and the outputs of the next one must also look like that. So you can basically encumber coins forever. But this isn't a really useful distinction, because you can effectively encumber coins forever, because you can say your output must look like this. And one of those outputs, says that the next one must look like this. I mean, you've got to step through it, but computers are really fast and I can encumber the next like million spends of a coin in probably under a second, right? So I can make that chain as long as I want. So the fact that it's not technically infinite, but especially with check lock time verify, I can say, well, you can only do one spend every hour and I've encumbered it for the next, 100 million hours. It's forever.
I just like to, for people listening, kind of make a little finer point there. Although I do agree that in the grand scheme of things, the important issue is having to pre-compute versus not pre-compute everything.
Yes.
But I do think it's not really practical to kind of create that long chain of locks in the way that people think it is with things like CTV. Because let's say that the whole thing you're worried about is receiving these coins where you can only spend them at like pre-approved merchants or whatever. In the case of CTV, like it's not just a simple linear commitment to like one path of where those coins get spent, because you don't know like how much money somebody is going to spend, where they're going to spend it. And so when you look at trying to use CTV for that type of thing, you're talking about an infinite like forking recursion where you have to go down to the single Satoshi and look at the value of that output and then cover every combination of place and amount that could be spent somewhere and then keep doing that recursively into infinity for every change output. So while it's totally possible to take like a single line and pre-compute that, if you're talking about like something that would be usable in general commerce, like that's just not practical or scalable.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is where your distinction is exactly on point, right? The difference is it partial or full specification? Do you specify exactly what the transaction looks like, or do you specify some part of it? And this is really interesting, because the OpsCTV already steps over that and says, actually, we're going to specify some parts of the transaction. In particular, it doesn't specify all the inputs, right? So the simplest covenant would be op TXID verify, right? Which would be literally, this is the transaction ID of the thing spending this output. Right? And basically saying, the only transaction that can ever spend this is this one, right? That would be the simplest covenant form that we could come up with, right? And op check template verify is not that. It does not just do that. And that would be really simple. And one of the reasons is, there's a couple of reasons, but one of the reasons is that you often want to add fees later, right? You don't know what fees are going to be in the future. So locking yourself into a particular transaction may look really, really foolish should fees spike and you're suddenly like, oh crap, I can't actually spend this now. Now you can use child pays for parent perhaps, but it depends on whether your outputs are time lock encumbered and all those things. So we've already crossed that point from fully specified to partially specified, but it does fully specify all the outputs, which makes it restricted, right? Now, I guess I come back to first principles here, like as if you go, well, should we allow generic covenants? And I'm like, well, Satoshi never disabled anything because he said, oh, wow, this is too powerful for humans to handle or any crap like that, right? It was always, you know, otherwise he would have gone away and done something else and not invented Bitcoin, right? So the idea that wow, this thing's too powerful, perhaps we shouldn't enable it, is not an argument I find convincing at all. I think we should, as long as it is neat and technically feasible and will allow cool things in the future, I think we should probably look seriously at how do we do this technically the best, right? What's the technical, you know, design things that we can make the best possible thing that we can do. And then if we want to introduce it slowly, I think it's worth looking at what would the generic thing look like. Okay, this is what a whole, you know, covenant system would look like. And they go, cool, but let's soft fork it in slowly, but not randomly, right? If we want to have some limited ability to start with, that's fine, but don't keep adding more and more different warts to the system. So we've got this op check template verify, and then we go, oh, we want op check template verify 2, and then op check template verify 3, and all these things. Because remember, in Bitcoin, we can only ever add new rules. We can't really take them away. So once we've put something in, we are stuck with it forever, and the code has to handle it forever. So we tend to be really cautious, not only about the changes that we make, but what that means technically from the point of view of, you know, everyone has got to check this stuff forever, and we need to maintain that forever. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that there's so much debate and nuance around the different proposals, because we're going to be stuck with this. Our children are going to be stuck with the decisions we make here today.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you know, like I said, when we started this topic, like I don't really see fungibility arguments as like a valid counter argument anymore, but I'm still kind of skeptical about just jumping into full blown covenants, especially after ZMNS CPXJ on the mailing list, I think like 2 months ago now, maybe a month and a half, got into a long thread with Paul Stork. Yep. And kind of just spelled out how with a fully recursive covenant, you could just implement something like a drivetrain peg. And I do not like the idea of enabling the ability to make peg systems like that for other layers that directly interact with mining incentives. I mean, I think there is worry potentially if Bitcoin actually does become a global money that everything's running on, for that to potentially destabilize the mining incentives altogether. If you literally have entire nations' economies running on that and you have coins encumbered where miners could just steal them, I think that's the type of thing where you might just see a permanent fork of Bitcoin that never resolves itself. And like that is kind of damaging to the whole idea of building a single system around a single network effect. And I'm also really concerned about how the economic incentives play out there in terms of the validation cost for miners and how centralized that could make dependence on like central entities like mining pools. Because once you kind of activate the ability to make a two-way peg like that involving miners, like you've just opened the door. Like there's no guarantee that a sidechain somebody makes is just going to be some sane, like small, easy to validate block size. Like you could just hitch something like BSV and just go full retard onto Bitcoin's miners. And I think one of the biggest vulnerabilities of Bitcoin right now going forward for the next 10 years, 20 years is the miners' kind of exposure to regulatory or government interference or capture. And so like turning on something like a fully generalized covenant, which just completely opens that door to never be closed again to all of these types of incentive distortions, really worries me. And, you know, to just be blatantly honest about this, like any preve out kind of half opens that door as well with things like Ruben Thompson's space chain design. And Jeremy Rubin just dropped an idea for also doing a drive chain peg design using APO. And so like I think is really my main reason now for wanting to start very simply with something like CTV or the proposal that you just dropped today, which looks like it would be much simpler to upgrade slowly over time rather than just right out of the gate, just blow everything open into fully generalized covenants.
Yeah. So I think, okay. So there's a couple of interesting points here. The first is the miner incentive thing is that's really hard, right? Meta miner incentives are, you know, threatened by a whole pile of things, many of which are already outside our control, right? Somebody starts a successful fork of Bitcoin and the miners go and mine that, right? We're all screwed. Somebody starts using Bitcoin blocks for like a lottery that actually becomes more valuable than, like, so they use the block hash as like a random thing for their lottery, right? And they go, cool, you win the lottery if you, you know, guess the hash or whatever, right? Of the next block. And the problem with that is that if that lottery becomes big enough, it biases miners to like, you know, to suppress blocks and crap like that because they're trying to get the winning lottery numbers. Any system that builds on Bitcoin that is bigger than Bitcoin itself has, I think, these properties that it can screw with the incentives.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't stop people from building on. So I think to some extent you're in the, you know, hey, not your coins, not your control. You can't, you know, you're going to have to chill about that. People are going to do stupid stuff with their coins all the time. And if enough people do stupid stuff, you're in trouble. And that, but that's the fundament, right? We already came back to that. If everyone decides to go east and you're going west, it's going to be very lonely. And, you know, now there's a question of degrees, but I think people will figure out a way to do these things. People are going to figure out, Shinobi, they're going to figure out ways to do stupid stuff without our help. That I think is a universally true thing. So I find it hard to like look at some technical thing and unless it's obviously stupid to go, we shouldn't do it for that reason. Particularly when there are valid things that people want to do with these things, right? So if no one could come up with a reasonable use for it, I'd be like, well, I'm not going to waste my time on it. But there are also reasonable things that you would want to do with covenants, right? There are decent, sane things that I might want to do, you know? You know, the idea of this, like the cold storage vaults and stuff like that is kind of cool, where you could basically go, cool, you can spend this, but you can only spend it in this particular way, unless you have this super, super secret key, in which case you can pull it out. You know, that kind of covenant design is kind of interesting to me. So, you know, if you've got kind of nebulous worries on one hand, but you've got a concrete way of act, you know, of real use on the other. Now, your point, there is, of course, a technical point right here, where if we were to do something really foolish and have some opcode that was really, really hard to validate, that took like a whole heap, we could wipe out a whole heap of, you know, you can no longer validate with a Raspberry Pi, right? If we did something technically stupid, then, you know, we could obviously create an opcode that would be centralizing and things like that. And that's, I'm assuming here that technically we don't make script significantly harder to validate or, you know, buggy or all these things that bar is passed. And we're just talking about like meta incentives. And yeah, I think it's an argument for going slowly. I don't find it a convincing argument. I also don't find it an illuminating argument for which bits, like where the line is, right? So we've got all these things we could look at in a transaction. We're looking at covenants, you know, we talked about whether you can, you know, control the outputs or not. It's not illuminating for me to go, cool, well, where do we go? Other than, you know, you can have, at the moment, CTV says you have to specify exactly what all the outputs look like, which makes it infeasible to do, as you say, an arbitrary control structure because you don't know how much they're going to spend and stuff like that. So that's one line, but I don't know where the other lines are and which, you know, so if we go beyond OpsCTV, which is the interesting thing for me, because I think you need to think really long term when you're designing Bitcoin stuff, because we're going to be stuck with it. What would the next step be, right? What would the next thing be? Cool. Okay, now you can start writing transactions that have to inspect this other thing. And I don't know what that is other than you should just allow all of it. But I think I've got to thank Jeremy Rubin here for really making a lot of noise on this topic and bringing it to the fore. Because a lot of people considered, you know, covenant design kind of a too hard basket, right? It wasn't clear what the right things were and what the trade-offs were. And, you know, and most people just kind of pushed it in the corner. And he's been really agitating for this kind of OpsCTV, kind of mid-level covenant design, I would say. Not the simplest thing you could do, but not the full covenant design. And kind of going, cool, this is where I draw the line. And we should do this. And he has been very loud and vocal. And certainly forced at least me to seriously look at covenants in a way I had no intention of doing this year. So, you know, I don't know. I think your points are fair. I disagree with them. I think, you know, there's always a fear of unknown. And I think if Satoshi had been thinking that way, he would have just gone, no, we're not putting any scripting in. It's opening a huge can of worms. We don't know what people will do with this, which is fundamentally the argument, right? We don't know what people will do with this. They could do stupid shit. It could destabilize the whole thing. Maybe we shouldn't give them this power. And
the concerns are like the edge cases, right? Like the things we can't think about, the things that we can't consider right now.
But they're also the cool things, right? Lightning was the right was the thing. I mean, so Satoshi had an idea of doing payment channels, but full on Lightning. Like he put a scripting system in because of the stuff he didn't know, which is also the stuff to fear. Yes, but it is also the opportunity of people doing awesome things. And I guess I'm an optimist kind of person, and I naturally go to, yeah, look, if we can give people the tools to do awesome stuff, some of them will do terrible things, but I think some of them will do cool stuff.
I think, you know, now might be a good time to kind of break down your proposal, Rusty, because I'm not going to lie, like all of the alternative designs that have been pushed out in the last 6 months, I have been very skeptical of, either just because I think it's too generalized of a place to start, or they were just too narrow in terms of designing for a specific use case. But I think, honestly, your proposal is the first one that I might prefer over CTV, like with what I've kind of thought about since I glanced at it before we started.
Yep. Okay, so CTV, as I've said before, takes OpNop4 and turns it into this thing that basically hashes these certain parts of the transaction, not covering all the inputs, but, you know, the current input and the number of inputs and all the outputs and a few other things. And just makes this hash of that and goes, cool. Now, the thing you've got sitting on the top of the stack right now has to be exactly the same as that, otherwise you fail. And it's done that way for complicated backwards compatibility reasons, so that's the only way you can extend old school script. Now, in Taproot, so version one, SegWit, we got we do things in a different way. So in the old school way, it used to be if you don't understand something, like that, all these things are just no ops and you just ignore them. In Taproot V1, Anthony Towns, I believe, came up with this, and it's brilliant. If you see an undefined opcode, something you don't do, you just it's success. The answer is yes, all good. You can spend the coins, go for that, and that makes it much more upgradable. It means that in the future, opcodes can do all kinds of things, right? With the op-nop idea, the only thing an opcode can do basically is fail at that point. So we take advantage of this thing that was invented for TypeScript v1, and we go, cool. So in TypeScript v1, we will have a new opcode called optx, and it will take a series of like 32 bits that basically say, here, take these parts of the transaction and do stuff with them. And you can say, do you want the inputs? Do you want, you know, particular parts of the input? Do you want the version number? Do you want all these things, right? And there are other bits that say, hey, do you want me to hash them all together? Do you want me to just like put them all in a row? Do you want me to push them on the stack as separate bits? And so it's a very, very generic, here, I want to look at the transaction that's spending, right? That's basically optx. So it's a very generic name. And you say what parts to look at, and you know, and it does that. Now this is incredibly generic, right? But the trick here is that to start with, we say, you have to set exactly the bits that are equivalent to object template verify, right? So you're only allowed to look at the things that object template verify would let you look at, and you have to hash them together and put that on the stack. And any other bits are op success. So we can define them in future, but for the moment, you're very restricted. So it's a very generic design that lets you do all these cool things in future. But right now, we only enable the part that basically gives you op check template verify, so CTV. The cool thing about this is that it gives us a way forward. We don't have to do an op CTV2 and be stuck with, everyone uses CTV2 these days, but we've got to support the old op CTV because we promised, and promises are forever in Bitcoin, right? So it's basically the same thing, only it is basically has a road, clear road forward, rather than being this, okay, technical compromise that some people feel that if we want to go further, we're going to be stuck with, and it's going to be ugly, which was my concern with OpsCTV. Not that it was, not that I think it's a bad place to draw the line and go, cool, let's start with these ones. It's that I think pretty clearly we're going to want some other things, and that was always going to make CTV ugly. And so in future generations, we're going to look back and go, oh man, that was a pain, right? So it's a generic thing, but then it's soft forked back down to this minimal thing. So I've tried to kind of square the circle here, but it does have some disadvantages. You cannot use this in either V0 SegWit or pre-SegWit outputs. It has to be in a TypeScript because that's the only thing that has this op success. Now, if we discover after people use this and do all these things that there really is a subset that's far more common than anything else, we go, cool, actually, almost all the time you want op CTV. You want those particular bits, and that's the right thing to do, and it's this really common use case. And hey, this opcode is like 5 bytes long. It'd be really nice if we had, like a shortcut version for the really common case. Then we could totally do opnop 4 or opnop 3, take one of those opcodes and turn it into just that specialization later on. And to be fair, we already do this in Bitcoin for the public key case, right? The standard, I just want to spend this. If you've got this signature by this key, you can spend it, right? We already have a shortcut for those because it's such a common case. We don't have to spell it out in script. You can, but the standard things don't. We can totally put in a shortcut later, but doing it today is doing it backwards. It's a premature optimization to take an opcode and give it for some special case when we don't even really know that that's going to be the most common thing that we do.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of just approaching things the same way SegWit did. Like SegWit redefined an opnop, but set it up so that you could version that and just keep iterating how that single newly defined opcode is validated instead of having to eat up a new one each time because we only have so many before we run out of them and can't add new bare opcodes.
Yeah. And this is part of what I kind of came back to at the beginning, right? Is that we are still learning how to do this. The op success thing is in retrospect obvious. But as Andrew Polster said, even the idea of a soft fork versus a hard fork Bitcoin upgrade really only came about in 2012. So it took us a few years to really realize the right way to upgrade Bitcoin. And it was only really with TypeScript that we realized the right way to upgrade script was to define everything as op success and then take those away later on. This is all part of that learning experience. And I think that's that's natural because this stuff is hard and weird. And this gives me sympathy for the OpsCTV crowd going, actually, we want to have it out there so people can play with it, so we can learn stuff, so we know what we want next. There are people who are like, no, let's go full covenants because we know we want them. And I'm like, I think we want them too, but my experience in Bitcoin has led me to go that we're not as smart as we think we are. And there is real benefit in having something out there that people can play with, because people will come up with cool new things, and that will set our priorities for what we would turn on next, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, nobody sees everything 100% clearly. And I think like a good example of that is the making one of the point variables in Schnorr pub keys implicit. When the whole proposal for Tapleaf Update Verify was dropped, that created a whole big problem, because now you have to make sure that when you add or subtract a key from a Schnorr multisig, that what you wind up with is a valid key. Otherwise, you could wind up just burning coins. And that adds a lot of client side, you know, work that has to be crunched and computed anytime that is used, to make sure that you don't wind up with some combination of somebody wanting to leave like a multisig output where everybody else's coins wind up getting burned because it's not a valid pub key according to the Taproot rules.
We do learn things, and importantly, right? So I guess there was a really dumb soft fork in Bitcoin's history that predates me.
P2SH.
No, that look. Hey, you know, P2SH was good because it made room for to do it properly with SegWit, right? But the dumber one I was thinking of was basically the forcing the block height in the Coinbase. Right. The correct way of doing that was to set the end lock time on the Coinbase transaction, right? To set it to the block height of. It's clean. It's already a 32-bit field. It's designed to put a block height in there. Why the hell do you put it in the beginning of the script pub key for it? That's like just, that doesn't even make sense, right? So there was a smarter way of doing it, but we're stuck with those old rules because that was, you know, it was early on. It was all a little bit more free and loose, and nobody quite. There's several things going on. One is like not enough eyeballs, just not enough serious developers looking at it. Two, it wasn't important enough at the time. It was early days. Nobody cared. It was a little bit of an experiment. And three, nobody really understood that they were going to be stuck with these decisions forever. So we're now aware of that. And so there's a lot more eyeballs. There's a lot more thought. There's a lot more care going on about any upgrade. There's almost a counterpoint here. There's like a clock ticking. We know at some point the protocol is going to ossify, right? We're not going to be able to upgrade anymore. And we've talked about this anarchic upgrade process. And you know, I'm not sure that that works when your nation states are at play. Nope. When there's so much on the line that you can no longer have this bonhomie of like of developers all getting around trying to mutually find out the best thing. But people start game playing and, you know, trying to sneak stuff in, and dishonest motives start appearing. And that's inevitable. And it happens with any standardization effort, right? When standards start as like a group of geeks getting together to try to figure out the best way to do something. And at some point it transitions to large corporations doing, you know, nasty gameplay to try to get their patented technology in and all this kind of crap that occurs. Now, not universally, but at some point when things get big and important, particularly when you get this generational shift of the original people move on, we see this, right? It no longer becomes an attempt to produce technical excellence, and becomes an opportunity to aim for your particular angle. So being aware of this, I suspect Bitcoin may be particularly vulnerable to this idea that there will be a huge amount of disinformation, and it will be increasingly difficult to be confident that a change is good. And so at some point, most reasonable people will go, no, Bitcoin cannot be changed anymore. I don't care how good your excuse is. It's not. Unless the whole thing's imploding, we are absolutely not going to change it anymore.
I mean, so, if it doesn't play out that way, then this was always going to be a failed experiment. Like, it's one or the other, in my opinion.
How close do you guys think we are to that? Oh, are we already there?
We're going to find out. Every time, yeah, there's so much stuff to do. Look, every time we have this debate, we wonder, is this the time that we're going to just stall, right? Every time there's a software proposal, you're always thinking in the back of your mind, is this the one where people go, no, it's not worth the risk. It's not worth the risk to the system to make this change that I don't think benefits me enough. And you should be thinking that. That is a totally fair and reasonable thing to think, right? Is this worthwhile? The people want to change this. Is it worth it? Right? No change is free. And you know, how conservative do you need to be? That's an individual choice. You've really got to, you know, assess things. I don't think we're there yet. I'm pretty sure we're not there yet. But I would suspect that we're going to get there at some point. I don't know. Above my pay grade to figure that out.
I mean, but it's kind of interesting, right? Because, I mean, we had Taproot, which I think a lot of us thought was going to be more difficult to actually activate and, you know, implement and activate. But that kind of just flew through with the speedy trial activation. And then Jeremy tried to propose this with the speedy trial activation and everyone flipped fucking shits. And I'm not saying that maybe that's the right move to flip shits at that, but like, how do we activate going forward? What's like, do you guys think speedy trial is a good method?
No,
nobody likes speedy trial. Taproot was just so unanimously, obviously great, and opt-in. So you didn't have to use it. It didn't take anything away. It was, you know, it had been really well studied, really well thought out. It had been a lot of time had passed. We were pretty sure there was nothing better coming down the horizon. There were no big question marks. You know, it had all the things, including a lot of time to bake and a lot of broad discussion, a lot of, you know, it had been done in the right way and everyone was pretty comfortable with it. So I said at the time a blind monkey could activate Taproot, and yeah, sure, speedy trial. We could have chosen any method. We could have chosen throw darts at the board and it would have activated, right? So, you know, it both wasn't a fair thing for speedy trial because it was so easy to activate. And also, you know, we're also at a unique time where nobody really has an interest in Bitcoin ossifying, not any significant players. And the miners were a little bit cowed from their previous experience with, you know, forking. And so, you know, in view of all that consensus, it was going to be really hard for anyone to like push back on it. So it was almost optimal conditions for a fork. I don't think we'll see that again. It will only get harder from here in.
I mean, I have a really controversial attitude about how I think forks should get turned on going forward. I don't think miners or developers should have anything to do with it. Like actually half of the reason that I did that troll patch of my node last year to just enforce, Taproot from Genesis was, me and a buddy of mine have been talking for a while. And I think, actually Rusty in the next core release, this is something developers are doing now. But just, I think everything should be a UASF. I do not think that miners or developers should really be deeply involved with the activation of anything. And I think that that is really the only way going forward to really create a consistent, solidified dynamic where we maintain this mob and that dynamic where you don't just have that devolve into figureheads that are perpetually followed and listened to. And I think that either a feature done and turned on that way will gain the critical mass of support to successfully activate without too much disruption, or it will just be a bunch of goofballs like me with my single node getting attacked while everybody runs away from the one true Bitcoin. And, you know, after that point, developers can just go back and just flip a rule on from Genesis. Like, you wait and let other clients or other groups actually get something turned on. And if it's successful, then just flip it on in the next release. Like, I feel that developers should kind of just step back from the entire activation mechanic and just implement the validation logic of something. And if it's, if they, people want it and it gets turned on, then just flip that activation for a validation on in the next release.
But won't it always come down to figureheads no matter what? Like, there's, the overwhelming majority of people do not understand.
We should incentivize as many of them as possible instead of just let things devolve to fewer and fewer of them.
So I think, you know, I have some sympathy with your approach, and it's nice to have someone out there on the edge. Good luck to you. there are real shelling points, right? There are real points that make things a lot easier to deal with. And having the developers go, cool, this is what we think is the best thing, is a perfectly reasonable thing for them to do. I do believe that it is very important that, you know, so just mechanically, there is a reason that you want to upgrade Bitcoin Core, because, you know, there are CVEs or other things, you know, vulnerabilities in previous releases, and, you know, there are other reasons, and speed improvements, you know. So there's a danger in tying upgrades to support for a particular fork, right? I think just that's
the interesting thing, though. If things were done my way, all those clients can be transitory. Like, you use it to turn something on and then switch back to Core.
Yeah. I mean,
how do you know if you hit the critical mass in your situation?
We have a chain split, or we don't have a chain split, or we have a chain split and no one notices because it's me just yelling at Wang Chung on Twitter.
So you end up having to sponsor, basically pay miners to try to split the chain to find out if people are enforcing it. The true test of enforcement is when somebody produces an invalid block and it gets rejected and does not get built upon. Now, statistically, that can happen sometimes. So you've got to produce a few of them. Like, it's a really expensive test to run, but it is the only true way to test whether or not people are enforcing the rules, is to break them.
So you, like pay the miner out of band or something?
You literally have to pay a bunch of miners out of band to produce what are now invalid blocks to see if anyone follows them, right? You know, it's really tempting to do. Now, fortunately, miners screw up all the time, and so sometimes they accidentally do this experiment. But you'd have to have some litmus test there where they, and they have to be stealth, right? So you can't just go, oh, well, all miners are blocking things from this pool because they know that pool's trying to produce invalid blocks and they haven't actually upgraded. They're just blocking, you know. So there are tricky mechanics in here. And it could be, so you produce an invalid block and they, oh, hey, no miners built on that. Yeah, but it happened to be produced at the same time as this other block, and maybe they stole the other block. So you got to, you know, there are problems with this approach. But fundamentally, that would be the test. Now, before that, everyone's nervous to use a new feature because they're not sure if it's enforced or not. So the miner signaling gives you a shelling point to go, cool, well, I'm pretty sure that everyone else is following that. My node has activated, is now enforcing that rule because it's sort of the miner signal. And I know everyone else will have seen the miner signal. So I'm assuming that all of us have moved forward together and we are all enforcing the rules. So now I have some degree of assurance, one, that the miners can't go back and stop enforcing the rules because all the nodes are already switched on and they're enforcing the rules, so the miners' block will be rejected. Secondly, I can start using this feature pretty sure that everyone's got my back, right? So there are real shelling points here, and the developer's role as setting shelling points for ways we coordinate things should not be confused with their endorsement of a particular fork or not. I mean, obviously, they have a responsibility to do things that they think are technically correct. As individual developers are like, I really like the soft fork. I think it's good for Bitcoin. Go ahead. But I have always believed that there should be an option well-documented to say, no, I do not want to support this fork. I want all the other good things, but no, I do not want this soft fork to go ahead, with full knowledge and documentation that means that you may be on your own. You may fork yourself off the Bitcoin network. But I think fundamentally that responsibility is in an end user's hands. So we should make it clear that it is in their end user's hands, right? At the end of the day, the nodes get to decide what the network is. And so we really need to make that, like putting gratuitous road bumps in, like, oh, yeah, you could do it, but you've got to run this patch software from this weird place and everything else, is putting a hurdle in the way of them actually exercising that sovereignty. And so I would argue that the developers should probably just give them all the pieces, you know, maybe set the defaults and say, cool, by default, it will do this, but you can totally turn it off. And just embrace the fact that some people will do dumb shit and they may well fork themselves off the network. And, you know, I'm sorry, at the end of the day, whether you like it or not, these people actually do have responsibility and control. And so you might as well recognize it. And I think trying to suppress it is dangerous.
So what you're referring to is like a toggle in the user interface? Like there's, yeah. You just switch it on or off?
You've got to be able to switch it on or off, right? And I've
argued
this before.
Everybody should try forking themselves off the network at least once. It's an invigorating experience.
But historically, there's been a ton of pushback on that as a concept, right?
Yep, absolutely. And I think there is, you know, developers, it's natural to kind of go, well, we know the system best and we should decide. Right. And the current crop of developers are fantastic and everything else, but I do worry about this generational change, right? I do worry about, you know, I trust the existing developers. Does that mean I trust all developers in the future? No. I have worked in open source software for like 25 years. I have had developers do stupid shit. I've had them go insane. I have had them... I'm not qualified to make that diagnosis, but I've had them do things that take your breath away. Things that you would not believe that, you know, no normal, you know, just things that you would consider to be extreme irrational behavior. I have seen that. Breakdowns, you know, self-destructive behavior, all these kind of things. Anything that you could say consider human done, do. I've seen developers do it to their own projects and everything else, right? So while generally I think open source developers are these godlike figures who strut across the world and bring peace and happiness and all those things that we do, you know, my experience has led me to believe that, you know, while I love them, I don't want to trust them, and you know, and things can go wrong, right? So I think the more self-aware developers would like to get rid of this, any perception of this having this power over the network, you know. And I think some of the younger developers don't feel the same, don't feel the same urge to withdraw themselves, right? I think that's something that comes with time and experience. And I worry that, you know, the next generation of developers will feel that they're the logical masters of the network. And I think that's dangerous.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
I mean, we actually, I think there should be a historical course for new developers on the likes of Gavin Andreessen and Mike Hearn.
I imagine like most people listening to the show right now don't even know who those people are, right?
Yeah. Very, very possible. I am constantly these days just randomly thinking like half of the Bitcoiners who got here since 2017 don't even know who Greg is.
Kids these days. Yeah, you know, and look, you're not a Bitcoin OG unless you're in Bitcoin before me, right? That's always everyone's definition of Bitcoin OG. So unless you had, you know, unless you're on the IRC channel, Bitcoin OTC, trying to get Bitcoin and using your GPG address to, like, you know, to do that, then you're not a real OG Bitcoiner. Sorry. I think. I don't know. Inevitably, you know, some knowledge will get lost and people will come in with different viewpoints. And as we go more mainstream, this is inevitable. But I do like the idea that we have a whole heap of, I think it is important for Bitcoiners to realize, and I believe that they do, that they have a responsibility at the end of the day. If you're a sovereign individual, then you are going to have a lot of responsibility over your own coins, right? It's running your own node. It's having your own stuff. And it means upgrades are, for better or worse, are going to be your concern. They're going to affect you to some extent, or at least you should make sure that you're happy that they don't affect you. Right. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe that doesn't scale.
Even if we don't have ossification, like pure ossification anytime soon, I think for like these major changes, the safer approach tends to just be to default to no, right? Like I was with this CTV conversation, I was hoping it was just going to kind of go away. Didn't really want to have the conversation or learn about it. And like my hand was forced, and a lot of freaks were like, Matt, you need to have a conversation about it on Scylla Dispatch. And I was like, I really don't want to, I don't even want to do it. Like, I just don't want to update, don't want to bother with it.
I mean, like, that's perfectly like rational. I mean, to say no by default, to be conservative to changes, to go, I don't understand or see how this benefits me, I'm not okay with this. All of those things are completely reasonable and what this system should be built on. The thing that's been driving me insane like the last 2 weeks is all of these people like confidently asserting like all these things that CTV can do to be a huge risk to Bitcoin or like break the system. And it's just like, no, that's factually incorrect. Either make a reasonable argument for why you don't want to do this, learn what you're talking about, or shut the fuck up.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I'm with Matt here. I was like, I don't want to care about this. I have a day job, and this is not it. So, I'm concentrating on Lightning and all those cool things, but you know, it reaches a certain point where you're like, okay, I've got to weigh in. I've got to have an opinion. I've got to read the BIP. I've got to think through it. And all those things. So I am also dragged here reluctantly.
It's like a critical mass thing, right? It's like there needs to be a certain critical mass or momentum to get any kind of real change in or get people to care about it.
Yeah. And classically, there's a certain amount of, well, you know, everyone's really busy doing cool stuff and everything else. And so almost it needs to get to the point where people feel, oh, crap, it's happening now before they'll even start paying attention.
Right.
Right. Which is too late. You really hope that everyone was paying attention the whole time. And by the time it got to the, oh, it's about to happen, you've had all those debates, you've had all these arguments, there's broad consensus. But in practice, it doesn't work that way, right? Same with Taproot, right? Everyone was happy with it, it shipped, and now people are finally starting, oh, we better start building all the stuff that we promised, right? So that's human nature. And that's okay. But yeah, I'm as much a victim of it as anyone else.
Like, what was your, when I invited you on the show, Rusty, your response was something like, oh, I would love to join, but why'd you have to choose that topic?
Yes. Yeah. But to be fair, again, like you made me get off my ass and post that OptX proposal that's been sitting in my inbox for like all my outbox drafts for a while that I've been bouncing back and forth with Anthony Towns, who had some good feedback. And I went, okay, well, I needed to post that last night, my time, or this morning, your time, because I'm like, well, I'm going to appear on Citadel Dispatch. So I better bring something to the show. Right. So that was an incentive for me to finally push that out.
Love it.
Otherwise we would have done this last week.
I love that. That's my contribution to the development process.
I mean, I think like, honestly, short, like the people who've just been actively spreading misinformation instead of just being a healthy level of skeptical, this was a really healthy thing to happen. Like it's forced actual information out into the community so that people can start really understanding this. It's brought the whole topic of covenants to like the wider discussion. I mean, all the annoyance, the nonsense, the drama. I think at the end of the day, this was a really healthy thing to happen.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because there's only a handful of people who have experience with covenants. And, you know, that will increase as people start playing with them more, as they seem more real. And that feedback loop is going to be interesting because I don't quite know where it'll lead. I would look to people like Russell O'Connor, who is the other Russell at Blockstream. And you can tell us apart, by the way, because if we're having an argument over something technical, he's the one who's right and I'm the one who's wrong. I always, you know, it'll be interesting. I think that as our thinking matures, there'll be people come forth with other ideas and we will reach consensus. Because I feel that we haven't had that level of like really rigorous oversight so far in this conversation. Because I think most people have been just staying on the sidelines.
I tend to agree that it does feel like this was overwhelmingly a healthy conversation and that one that needed to be had. It kind of feels like, I mean, we should have probably had this conversation before Taproot got activated, but at least we're having it now.
Well, I mean, ironically, when Taproot was still in development, Jeremy was trying to get CTV included in TapScript so that it could be embedded in a Taproot tree.
Yeah. Same with, you know, AnyPrevOut was the other one that was people were thinking, you know, hey, we really want this in. And you know, there was particular work around making sure that it could go in later. And this is the same, right? It's like, well, if it can be unbundled, it should be. And particularly, you know, Taproot was a pretty big deal. So that, to be fair, it's going to take us like 5 years to truly exploit.
Yeah, speaking of, is Simplicity still 2 weeks away?
Yeah. Yes, again, ask Russell O'Connor. I mean, you know, Simplicity is one of those things that's incredibly ambitious. And really, for humans like me to use it, it's going to have to be, you know, there's going to have to be like tooling on top that does the thing and turns it into Simplicity and you know, and does all of the great things that it does, because, you know, I'm not smart enough to write raw Simplicity. Hell, I'm not smart enough to write raw Bitcoin script. So, you know, tooling definitely has a long way to go on both of those.
Simplicity makes my head hurt. I barely understand any of it beyond the logic of formal verification. And there's definitely value I see in that. But I could not say two sentences besides it would let us do more complicated things and be sure they won't explode.
Yeah. Look, Simplicity is a great idea. So for those following along, Simplicity is basically a completely different scripting system, basically, that Blockstream Research under Russell O'Connor have been developing, particularly with an emphasis on being able to formally prove stuff about it in useful ways. So it's really great stuff. So you can go, cool, okay, I can prove that these coins will be spendable under these conditions and whatever else. So it's great from that point of view. And it's called Simplicity because it's basically the fundamental level. It's very, very simple, and you build everything up from that. But simple doesn't mean easy, right? So it all comes down to like the tooling and your ability to actually utilize this. And, you know, just because you can prove that something happens doesn't necessarily mean that you prove what you wanted to happen, right? You can still foot gun yourself, I'm pretty sure. So,
well, anyway, guys, this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. I know we're hitting the point where Rusty has some other responsibilities to take care of. I really appreciate both of your time. You know, this conversation has been very helpful to me. I often say that my favorite dispatches are the ones where I just sit quietly and listen. And I really needed this conversation, so I hope the freaks have found it helpful as well. I like to end the shows with final thoughts. So with that said, final thoughts, Shinobi.
Well, I guess just, you know, I would say when things like this come out of left field, like no as a default answer is totally reasonable. Like caution and skepticism and even paranoia is totally rational. But like you should not cross the line of actively misinforming people and stating things that you are not sure of or that are just hearsay to you about something being proposed, because that actively attacks and undermines the entire process of understanding something to see whether there is or isn't consensus. And also, Rusty, because of the time constraint and us not being able to get into that, I am going to twist your arm to come back on sometime to talk Lightning, because this
yes.
was a really fun yes. conversation.
Yeah, we should totally do that.
Well, thank you, Shinobi. I agree that we should have that conversation as well. And final thoughts, Rusty.
Yeah, so covenants are not necessarily something to be feared. Bitcoin script is getting more powerful. And, you know, there's always been good and valid questions over that. I do think, you know, there's a meta incentive question that is harder to answer. Like, as we make Bitcoin more powerful, are we risking people build things on top of Bitcoin that we don't like, either because they destabilize Bitcoin or because they're stupid or whatever else? But fundamentally, you know, that on a technical level, I think, you know, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing evil or novel about Bitcoin covenants. On the other hand, I echo what Shinobi said, that, you know, caution is, you know, as long as not gone to ridiculous lengths, caution is very, very important to Bitcoin. And so we should be slowly and carefully. And that means it's going to take years, and that's okay.
Cheers to that. Well, I want to thank you both again. I look forward to having you both on Dispatch in the future to have that Lightning conversation and other conversations, hopefully. And I want to do a huge thanks to all of our listeners who continue to support the show and join us in the live chat. Cheers, all. Thank you. I did my home, you build a wall. I dig my hole, you build a wall. One day that wall is gonna fall.
Gonna build that city on a hill. Gonna build that city on a hill. One day those tears are gonna spill. So my enemy,
pray for me. I'm praying that somebody hope for me. I'm staying where nobody supposed to be. Posted, being a wreck of emotion. Ready to go whenever you let me know. The road is long, so put the pedal to the flow. The enemy on my trail, my enemy is available. I'ma send
hasta luego.
They wanna fly on my trot to the top. I've been out of shape, thinking out of the box. I'm an astronaut. I blasted off the planet, rotten to cause catastrophe. And it matters more because I had it. Had I thought about wreaking havoc on an opposition. Kinda shocking, they want a static. With precision, I'm automatic. Quarterback, I ain't talking second. Pack it, pack it up, I don't panic. Batter, batter up, who the baddest? It don't matter, cause we the
Love you, freaks. I hope you found that conversation as helpful as I did. Really do appreciate all your support, watching the SAT stream in, watching the boosts come in through the podcasting 2.0, watching the BTC Pay server get hit. It really is an honor and a privilege to be with you guys every Bitcoin Tuesday. It's something that I really do love doing, and I appreciate you all. Now it's time for me to have 20 Bitcoiners over and grill them some steaks. Love you all. Stay humble and stack sats. Cheers.